this is based on some work that I did in collaboration with Monica Blanke and Yuval Grossman at Cornell, and that came out in May. And then there's a second part, a sequel, which is some work in progress, and we added Shamayita Ray, also at Cornell, for this part, and it should be coming out sometime next month. So there is some work in progress at the end. Now, this is, I'm told, a very informal talk session, so feel free to jump in and ask questions as I go through. Sorry? Okay, good, good. So what are we going to do today? I'll start off with a little bit of motivation. I won't go too far back into the big picture, but I want to talk about CP violation a bit. I'll move on to talk about the main idea of that first paper, and which is a way to get CP violation without mixing, without triple products, without the usual buzzwords for CP violation. So that's the main idea. And then I'll go through some additional ideas that we had for enhancing the asymmetry that the observable that we're going to get in part two by exploiting phase space. I'll run quickly through a SUSY example of this just to show you how it might be relevant for life in the real world, and then I'll conclude. So we begin with some motivation, and I just want to present the big picture question that we're asking, and that is, can we see CP violation directly in new states that we produce at the LHC? So where how does this fit into our program? Our program at the LHC is, well, first thing we want to do is discover some new states, and hopefully that will happen sometime very soon, you know, next year, maybe. So hopefully we'll do this. So step one is a check, we hope. There's been a lot of work on step two, which is to measure the masses and spins of these new states once we discover them, and that's sort of how we're going to tell whether it's supersymmetry, extra dimensions, strongly coupled theory, what have you. So that's step two. Step three, somewhere a little bit further down the line, so this is not, you know, next year, but maybe in a few years, is to try to determine the couplings, flavor, and in particular CP violation in whatever new theory we're dealing with at the LHC. Now, the step three is interesting because it's sort of to attack step three, we're going to want some sort of complementary approach. We want some input from LHCB and Super B factories in helping us decipher this part. But what I want to talk about is, can we do this directly in the new states that we're producing at the LHC? So I'm not going to talk about low energy Stein-Mall observables. Our idea is fairly general, so it might be applicable in that case as well. So why do we care about CP violation anyway? Well, we have this beautiful unitarity triangle that works extremely well. There are no significant deviations. So Stein-Mall works. And basically what this shows is that we have a bunch of different measurements that all overlap and indicate a single CP violating phase in our CKM matrix, and there are no issues yet, but there are some three sigmas that appear in the B sector, and apparently the D sector now as well. So we don't think that this will hold forever. We hope that we'll start discovering some new CP violation, and that maybe it could be at the LHC. One thing that makes us a little bit pessimistic is that the Stein-Mall works a little too well and seems to indicate that either the scale of new physics, at least based on CP violation, is really high, 10 to the 5 TeV, or that the coupling structure is very non-generic. So this is the new physics flavor problem, and
wait, but this bond has the 5 TeV, that's not CP violation, is it?
This is just flavor changing and including CP violations. So there's a strong bound from things like epsilon K and other CP violating observables as well, because this unitarity triangle works so well. So the CP violating couplings are also in the flavor sector are certainly constrained, put fairly strong constraints on your scale, and or on the couplings, if you will. Okay, so that's the state of the art. But we think that there are good reasons to think that this is not the full story. And the one good reason is baryogenesis. And in order to get the observed baryon antibaryon asymmetry that we see in the universe, we need a bunch of conditions that Sakharov outlined. And I just want to highlight the fact that CP violation is one of them. And so you might say, well, the standard model has all three of these conditions. Why do we care about new sources of CP violation then? Well, the point is that the standard model falls short. The standard model predicts an asymmetry of about 10 to the minus 19, which is 9 orders of magnitude too small compared to the observed baryon-antibaryon asymmetry. So we think there should be new sources of CP violation. They could well be at the TEV scale. And so the next step is, okay, if they're at the TEV scale, how do we see them? So they are fairly generic in these in models of new physics at the TEV scale. So so CP violation enters as some new CP odd phases that appear in your Lagrangian. So if you have some complex coupling in your Lagrangian that you can't get rid of by redefining your fields, then that's a physical source of CP violation, and that's sort of what we want to measure. That's what we want to look for. The problem is that when you try to observe these CP odd phases, you're looking for a phase, and in order to measure the phase, there are a bunch of complications. And one is that you need, in addition to the CP odd phase, a CP even phase that is coming in through the dynamics of the process. So this is not something in your Lagrangian, but it's something that's coming in through the dynamics. And we'll see exactly how that comes up in a little bit. And so I just want to present the main challenge here, which is how can we get a large and calculable CP even phase? So this is the big challenge of looking for CP violation in our case. So, I guess I should answer with video or answer?
Oh, you're multitasking. You're on answering phones and you're doing that. Impressive.
Great. Okay, is everything okay? Okay, good. So I just wanted to quickly run through this argument that we need these CP even phases. So what we're trying to get at is some CP violating observable. And generically, the sort of CP violating observables we look for are asymmetries of this form, where gamma here just represents the rate for some process. It could be a differential rate, I don't care. It's supposed to be very generic. And gamma bar is the CP conjugate process. So this is how we see.
It doesn't be concrete. Gamma could be a decay process rate, or it could be a scattering rate.
Or it could be a scattering rate, or yes, exactly. And so I'm being very agnostic about what gamma is at this point. But either way, it's some physical rate, so it's going to be proportional to the square of some amplitude. And if we write down our amplitude, so say we have some CP violating phase phi that we want to observe, we write down some amplitude, it has a magnitude and a phase, which is the CP violating part, and you have some CP conjugate process, which has the opposite phase, and then you try to calculate some asymmetry between the squares of these amplitudes. Well, of course, you square these amplitudes, the phase goes away. So that doesn't work. So you say, well, if I have some interference now and two different terms with different phases, then, well, the interference term will then be depend on the phase. And so maybe you can be sensitive to the phase in that way. But then when you square the amplitudes, you find the interference terms exactly cancel.
Those are odd phases, right?
So those are CV odd phases, yes. Great. Yes. So now we add into the game these CP even phases, and we see how this actually works. So if we add in CP even phases, so you notice in the CP conjugate process, they don't change signs. Then you take the square amplitude minus its CP conjugate, and you find that you get something that's not zero, and it depends on the fact that these phases are not zero and different. So there are three requirements, very generically, to see CP violating observables of this form. You need two contributing amplitudes. They need to have different CP odd phases, and they need to have different CP even phases. So the challenge for us now is, how do we get these CP even phases, and how do we make them large and calculable? OK, so where do we get them from? There's two ways that I want to highlight. One, which is the one we'll focus on, is from unstable states. So you have some unstable state that comes into your process, and we're going to assume it's sort of particle-like for now, but it doesn't depend on that. It could be some very broad resonance. So in the time-dependent picture, you get some e to the iet, that's a phase. And that's exactly going to be the CP even phase that contributes when you have some unstable state that comes in. In the time-integrated picture, so in field theory, the sort of perturbative field theory picture, that's kind of like a Bright-Wigner. It is exactly the equivalent of a Bright-Wigner. And so if you have some, if you notice this thing, it has a non-trivial phase to it. And that's what's, that's sort of the equivalent of this in the time-integrated picture. So we're going to focus on field theory pictures because we're going to assume that states decay promptly. So how do you get this? So how do we see this come up in the Steyer model? So this is how we've really looked for CP violation, or at least seen CP violation so far in the Steyer model. You can either look through, you can either get this CP even phase through rescattering. So if you have strong interactions, you get rescattering in the of the final states, and that's very hard to calculate. So you don't have a computational handle on it, and you usually have to either cancel it out in some clever way, or find some way to measure it. But you can't really, so you can't really calculate it from first principles. The other way that we can get the CP even phase is through mixing. And so mixing means you have a different E coming in, or a different M in the Bright-Wigner picture. And so that can give you a CP even phase. But mixing then requires that you have two states that have a delta M that's of order the width of the particle, assuming they have the same width, or delta gamma of order gamma. So that's actually a non-trivial constraint, and it's kind of hard to satisfy. But these are the traditional ways that's been done. And I'll just mention once here and once later on, there's also the idea of triple products, but I won't talk about them very much.
But this distinction is slightly artificial, because even in those cases where you actually get a triple product,
yes,
you end up finding that you need those conditions anyways. You will not be able to get that triple product without having some strong phase.
So as far as I understand, that's not actually the case, because you have an effective pi by 2 phase that comes in through the I epsilon.
Right, but this part will either come. So the only other way of getting it, that you have mentioned, that is if you have it in your coupling.
Okay.
So that's where you might get that.
Yes, so that's essentially what this sort of thing is, what the triple product sort of thing is.
But you can get a different triple product even from just that sort of thing.
You can get a triple product from this?
Right, so if you have a cascade,
yeah,
and an internal particle is off shell,
yeah,
then the internal particle in the three body decay can produce exactly the effect with a scripted gamma.
Yeah, but you can also produce it through triple product. I think it's a distinct thing, because you get an effective pi by 2 phase from these guys, and you only need to be proportional to the cosine of any additional CPE bin phases.
Okay, we can talk about it later. But even in that case, in the state, you have to be off shell to see an effect.
Okay, we can talk about this later. I'm not sure I see exactly why that's the case, but
I could be wrong.
Okay, we can talk about it after. Great. So, in any case, I'm gonna focus on this sort of situation. And so I want to introduce the main idea that we're going to be dealing with is, well, we talked about having this CPE bin phase coming from having different m's or different gammas. That's when you have mixing. We're going to talk about a case where you get a CPE bin phase from a different q squared, from a different virtuality of this resonance. And when does this come up? Well, we're going to see that comes up in three-body decays when you have two different orderings, and I'll explain exactly what that means. It's easier to see in pictures. And where the resonance can go on shell, and this is just so that the phase is large. If the phase is largest when you're nearly on shell, but not quite. So we'll discuss this in a lot more detail in the next part. And then the second half of the talk will be devoted to how can we see this phase? How can we make this realistic? And the idea here is to use momentum asymmetries to get an enhancement. And we'll see how that works. And we'll also discuss the question of feasibility at the LHC. So that's the plan from here. So now I want to delve more into this idea of CP even phases without mixing. How do we get this CP even phase from the virtuality of some resonance? And so here's what the sort of thing we're thinking about. So we're thinking about three-body decay again with a single resonance that dictates this decay. And that just means that we have no mixing. You could have mixing in the real world. That's perfectly okay. But we want to isolate the new effect and focus on that. So we're going to assume no mixing just for that purpose. We're also going to assume weak coupling, and what weak coupling buys us is that we can consider the Bright-Wigner approximation, and that gives us our constraint of calculability, makes everything nice and easy. You're not assuming the Bright-Wigner approximation, that's essentially the strong rescattering type of CP even phase anyway, and so we know about those, they're hard. So we want our resonance to be narrow so that this approximation is good, but we don't want it to be too narrow, because if the resonance is too narrow, then it can't go off shell at all. And we know that we want it to go slightly off shell. And if it's really, really narrow, then you can imagine it being long-lived and having displaced vertices and things like that. And we don't want to worry about that for now. So in order to explore this a little further, I want to introduce a toy model. And like the toy model displayed over here, it's nice, warm, and fuzzy, and makes you feel good. But at the end of the day, it's not real. So.
What? They're not real?
No. Imagine discovering the Higgs was that easy. So here's the model. It's very simple. We only have five particles. They're all scalars, because scalars are easy. And we're considering three-body decays that look kind of like this. This is only one of the diagrams for now, just to point out exactly how things are coming in. You have a mother particle, x0, which decays to three final state particles, x1, x2, and x3. X3 is neutral. These guys are charged. And there's some resonance that comes in here, y. And that's the resonance that we're going to assume can go on shell, et cetera. For now, 1 and 2 are going to be distinct particles. But in general, they can. We're going to take the limit where these two things are degenerate. And we'll see that that's a very interesting limit from a phenomenological point of view. But it also introduces a lot of complications. And that's going to be the second half of the talk. There's also a hierarchy of scales here, which will be more relevant when we actually stick this in a real model. And that's just so that you can have on-shell decays. Okay, great. So what are the interactions then? We're only going to assume two couplings. And to make things really simple, we're going to assume that the couplings are universal in the charged particle choice over here. And what this buys us is that there's only one CP odd phase that comes into this model, this one physical CP odd phase, which is the difference between the phases of these two couplings. And so one CP odd phase, that's very easy.
Aside from the fermions, choosing fermions, you're almost doing this is exactly what happens in ANSYS.
Yeah, so
it's not too silly of a toy model.
It's not too silly of a toy model, but the approximation, the point that they're all scalars is actually a huge simplification.
Yeah.
It's a ruled out toy model.
Yeah. Well, so I'm going to talk about a ruled out toy model in a little bit. Yes. Okay, so here's the game plan. So here's our two interfering amplitudes represented by these two tree-level diagrams. You're going by some resonance y. And here's where we can see what I meant by two different orderings. So you have one decay where you first decay to an x1, and then the y decays to x2 and x3. Or you can first decay to an x2, and then the y decays to an x1 and an x3. And what that does for you is it makes sure that the virtuality that appears in these two resonances is different. Here it's Q23, it's made up by particles 2 and 3. Here it's Q13, made up by particles 1 and 3. And you also have two different CP odd phases. Here it's e to the I phi, and here you get a minus sign. So you have different CP odd phases, different CP even phases, so you should have CP violation. So now we just have to go ahead and calculate some asymmetries and see how that how this asymmetry behaves, and that's what we'll do now. So we calculate some. The object I want to talk about for now is this differential asymmetry, which is just the differential rate over all phase space in these Q squareds. So you can plot these things that look like Dalitz plots of the asymmetry. And we're going to just take a look at this Dalitz plot quickly and see some properties of this thing. Well, there are a few interesting properties. The first thing to note is that there's this line down the middle here where the asymmetry vanishes. And that's the line where Q13 squared is equal to Q23 squared. Then you have the same CP even phase contributing to both diagrams. And we know that we need different CP even phases to get CP violation. So along this line exactly, including the point where both where the resonance is on shell in both diagrams, you get no asymmetry. But you move just a little bit away from your resonance being on shell, and you start to get a large asymmetry in this plot. So it's about gamma m away from the point where the two are on shell. And so that's the main thing I want to highlight with this diagram. So then once we understand the differential symmetry, we might think to try to calculate integrated asymmetries. And then we run into an issue that's going to be the subject of the second half of this talk, which is that if you look at integrated rate asymmetries, you get a suppression by delta M12 squared over M0 squared. So if your final state particles are degenerate, in particular, you get no asymmetry. And that's just essentially because the integrated rate, the integrated process is the same thing as the CP conjugate. So of course, it's going to vanish. So we'll talk about that in a lot more detail in the next part. I just wanted to highlight one more thing while we're talking about the differential rates, that also applies for the integrated rates, which is that if the width of the resonance vanishes, then the asymmetry vanishes, because then you have the same phase contributing to both diagrams. So the asymmetry is actually proportional to the width. And in the narrow width limit, you get a suppression. And I just wanted to highlight that pictorially. You can see here is for 3% width to mass ratio. Here's for 15%. You get a much smaller asymmetry in when you have a narrow width than with a broader resonance. And that's going to be something that haunts us for the rest of this talk. So what are the lessons we've learned so far? We get this new CP even phase that comes up in three-body decays with different orderings and an on-shell resonance. The integrated rate we learned was suppressed by some mass splitting, and that's what I want to talk about now. How can we make this practical? And to do that, we want to exploit some phase-based tricks. Okay, so we want to get, so we learned that the integrated rate was sensitive to mass splittings. And what we want to do is eliminate this suppression by using a phase-based weighting. And what I mean by that, I'm actually going to go back to one of these plots. Any one of these plots will do. You notice that this whole half of the plot is positive. This whole half of the plot is negative. And the reason the asymmetry is canceling is because you're adding them together. A big positive number plus a big negative number gives you zero. So that's where the zero is coming from. But any individual point in phase space already violates CP. So why are we adding them up with the weighting that this is negative and this is positive? We can just add them up such that this is positive and this is also positive to get a large positive number. And that's sort of the phase space trick that we want to use. Of course, the way I've stated it now, that requires you to know the Q squareds. You need to be able to reconstruct this decay fully in the rest frame of the mother particle. And that's a challenge. I just wanted to highlight, in the extreme case of identical final state particles, you get a zero asymmetry, but you can get non-zero asymmetry by using this weighting trick. So what we're going to assume is that the charged particle kinematics are known, but that we don't necessarily know this the neutral particle. We had this X3 that escapes the detect that's neutral, and if it's some sort of LSP type thing, it could escape your detector. If it's not, then we can reconstruct the event and we're done. We just do this phase-based weighting. So if not, we can still construct momentum asymmetries using the charged particle momenta, and that's the sort of observable I want to talk about. Here's three examples. The ideal case would be if we had some rest frame. If we could reconstruct the rest frame, then we could just look at the charged particle, the positively charged particle momentum, negatively charged momentum negatively charged particle momentum, and see when one's bigger than the other, or the opposite case. And this actually forms a CP asymmetry. And it's exactly the same as doing that phase-space weighting trick. I'm not going through the whole calculation here, but it's fairly simple to see just looking at what Q squared actually is in the rest frame.
You can sort of do it, right, without knowing the rest frame, because the produced particle is more or less at rest.
Exactly. And that's exactly the trick that we're going to use. So that's exactly what I'm talking about with these other two asymmetries, which are lab frame asymmetries, but you're assuming that the mother particle is roughly at rest. And then you get an asymmetry in terms of the lab frame momenta. At hadron colliders, you even lose some more information because you're losing the information along the z-axis because your parton rest frame is not the same thing as your proton rest frame. So you can only really look at PT asymmetries. Those are the ones that are physically relevant. And then other things you can construct with momenta are things like triple product asymmetries, which again, I'm not talking about. Not for this one, because in this case, you just don't have enough kinematics. Your kinematics is not intricate enough. Yeah, you need at least a four-body decay or polarizations. Okay. Great. So we're considering, so for now we'll consider a decay in the rest frame of the X0 and just see how this actually gives you a CP asymmetry. I want to run through this argument quickly. You have some process that depends on P plus and P minus, which is this decay. The CP conjugate process, because we only care about the magnitude of P plus and P minus, P doesn't do anything, but the charge conjugation interchanges what you're thinking of as P plus and P minus. And so in particular, all points in phase space where P plus is bigger than P minus get mapped onto all points in phase space where P minus is greater than P plus. And so you can construct a CP asymmetry even in the case where you have identical final state particles 1 and 2, which is just this momentum asymmetry that I was discussing on the previous slide. And sticking with this rest frame asymmetry for now, I just want to see how we can get the largest asymmetry possible. We want a large width, as I mentioned earlier, just so that you can get a large asymmetry. But we're limited by weak coupling. And I'm going to just fix a value of 10% width to mass ratio. You can play with that. It's roughly linear in this width to mass ratio.
But that's pretty generous, isn't it?
As in?
As in, you know, gamma over n is roughly alpha over.
Yes. Yes. So if we're considering, exactly, if we're considering supersymmetry or something like that that's weakly coupled, then yes. This is still within the realm of the toy model for now. So I'm going to take the liberty to make it as large as I can. So of course, that's going to be a big issue. Yeah, so that's a bit of foreshadowing. And numerically, we find that if the resonance mass to the mother mass ratio is about 2/3, you get the maximal asymmetry. And that maximal asymmetry is about 40%, nice and big. So that makes us happy. Now we have to go insert a dose of realism. So if we could reconstruct the decay fully, then we were done. We can just construct these momentum asymmetries in the rest frame, if we knew the rest frame of the mother particle, and we would be done. More realistically, you might have something like pair production of these mother particles, where they decay in this way, and then X3, say, is neutral, so it escapes as missing energy. And so the best you can do is some lab frame asymmetries with the momentum and the PT. But that still works. That's the great thing. You lose only about a factor of a third in going from the rest frame to the lab frame.
Right, but here you're assuming that you know which one to pair with which.
That's the other nice thing. This includes combinatorics. So you make all possible combinations of P plus and P minus. And you still get a very small suppression from the combinatorics because the parts of phase space that matter most are roughly uncorrelated in P plus and P minus. So just so the average P plus is still bigger the average P plus is still bigger than the average P minus, or the other way around. I forget which way it actually works.
But doesn't it add to your denominator? When your denominator becomes larger.
Yeah, your denominator becomes larger, but your numerator becomes larger by roughly the same amount. Because of the combinatorics.
But it's just, the other combination should have non-CP violation in it.
No, but that's what I'm saying is that it does, because there is some correlation between, there's still some correlation because they're both coming from the same decay. They're coming from the decay of this X0, and positively charged particles coming out of this decay tend to be harder than negatively charged particles coming out of this decay, regardless. So I'm saying there's a small correlation. If you pick a certain P plus, there's a small correlation that you get that you're restricted to a certain P minus. Okay, so where we got? We have this idea of using momentum asymmetries to get practical CP violating observables. You get a washout by a factor of about a third, but that's not so bad. And now I want to run through with what time I have left, what kinds of models is this relevant in? Okay, so I'll go through this a little quickly. So I guess we don't really need to motivate the MSSM too much. It remains a leading candidate for physics beyond the standard model. It's rich with important CP violating phases, which can contribute to electric baryogenesis. Flavor changing processes are highly constrained. So are these guys because of EDMs. But it turns out that what I'm considering, the EDM bounds are roughly at the level, they're not too constraining for the particular process that I'm considering if you make certain assumptions that you may or may not like. So whereas the process that we are considering, we're considering the decay of a neutralino to two mu's and a lighter neutralino. I'm going to assume that this guy's Wino-like and this guy's Beano-like, just for simplicity. And then you have a left-handed smuon coming in there. What's going on? Hello? Okay. Are we good? Okay, good. So here's the decay we're considering. So here we, again, we have this phase space implying some scale hierarchy, but here it's a bit more relevant because it makes it look a little bit contrived. You have the neutralinos, this one, and the second neutralino has to be heavier than the first neutralino, that's okay. But you also need the fact that this smuon gets sandwiched between them. And we also find that the asymmetry is largest when the two neutralinos are nearly degenerate. So there's some sort of weirdness going on there in terms of the spectrum. But we'll ignore that for now and press on. Where the decays, so I'm showing you two of the diagrams that contribute to this. There are actually more. I have them in the backup slide if you want, but they're small. So I'm just going to focus on these two diagrams. You have different CP odd phases coming into them via these M1, via the Gaugino masses. So it's the Gaugino mass phase of M1, M2 star, which in the interaction basis, the mass basis actually goes into these interactions. No, it's not from the mu term. That's the important part. That's actually very important for why this is not ruled out by EVMs. It's actually the M1, M2 star phase. The mu term phase doesn't come in here because there's no Higgsino. So that can't actually contribute. And you have the same different orderings going on. First you decay to mu plus or first you decay to mu minus. Depending on which one you do, you get a different Q squared coming in. Yeah. And so you have different CP odd phases, different CP even phases. Again, you should have CP violation, and it's just a matter of how big is it. And the answer is, as Itai was pointing out before, not that big because of this width. The smuon width is very small. It's at most going to be, you know, of order alpha m. So you expect an asymmetry that's going to be at most about 1%, and that's what we find. You can get some numerical enhancements in some parts of phase space, but it's not that big. And so you say, well, maybe we can consider strongly interacting MSSM particles where you have less of a suppression. But then there are some. First of all, there are some stronger bounds on strongly interacting MSSM particles. But most importantly, it's tougher experimentally. You need to be able to tag the charges of these final state particles. And that's going to be very hard if you're considering, you know, jets.
You also have to worry about strong phases.
Yeah. So, but even strongly interacting particles at this point, by strongly interacting, I meant SU3 color. So even those are perturbative at these energies. So I think the main issue is really that you're looking at jets. If you had some new strongly interacting sector, then yes. You would get strong phases from there, and this would be completely dominated by those phases. Not to mention the bright Wigner approximation would probably break down. Okay, great.
But that part is good too.
It's good for getting a large phase, but it's not good for the calculability.
Yeah.
Calculability is the other requirement. Large is one requirement, calculable is the other requirement. Mixing the two is what's hard. Yeah. Great. So this begs the question, is this whole thing feasible? And we're still hopeful. So typically, but maybe not always, the asymmetries are less than about 1%. The cross-sections also pose a challenge, and I have a little bit about that on the backup slides. But basically, the main thing is that it's weakly suppressed. It's weak production of these bosons. If you're doing pair production of the neutralinos, it's weakly produced. We're thinking about ways in which you can get it through strong production, through the decay of some squarks or neutralino or gluinos. But that's sort of where the work in progress part comes in. So we haven't explored all channels. We're thinking about it coming out of decays, seeing what we can do in that case. Okay, so that's basically what I wanted to say. So let's wrap up and see where we are. So the take-home message is this. Triple products aren't the only game in town. We can get new strong phases if we have 3-body decays with an on-shell resonance and different orderings, as we saw in the first half. And then in the second half, hopefully I convinced you that observation at the LHC could be possible. You just have to construct momentum asymmetries to get rid of suppressions. There isn't a strong kinematic requirement. You just have to be able to measure the momenta of the charged particles in the decay. And there are small suppressions due to the lost longitudinal information and due to combinatorics. And so, where are we going from here? We want to consider other processes, maybe things with slightly broader resonances at least. We don't want to go too broad because of the calculability factor. There are some issues here with spin dependence. So when you put in the MSSM, things get a bit more complicated because you have spin dependence in the decays. And we want to eventually think about a full-blown collider study of this observable and see if we can actually do it at the LHC. And so that's it. Thanks. Well, we don't like to think about that alternative. Yeah, hopefully the future, it should be the future of, CP violation observables at the LHC, and hopefully we'll take that exit, not the exit that says no CP violation seen at the LHC.
Well, I think Cliff is more worried about nothing seen that is.
Nothing seen at the LHC. Oh, that's a really depressing exit. That's way further on the highway. Yeah.
Any other questions? So, did you guys think at all about trying to do it sort of rather per production, but trying to do it for S channel?
So S channel X zero production, or?
Well, that would not be MSSM like, but
yes. So I looked into that a little bit. One thing there is, I think it's a bit harder to motivate why the neutral particle would be stable. If it has, maybe if it has small couplings to its decay products, if it's like a gravitino or something, you can do that. I think that case is a little bit more straightforward. You should still get very large asymmetry. So I at least when I looked at it in the toy model, you seem to get large asymmetry still. So yes, definitely S channels is interesting too. It's just not as relevant for Susie.
The thing that got you in the end always was the width. So if you could get the width to be bigger, then
yeah. It's very hard to do that in the MSSM because the couplings are kind of fixed for the most part. It's all same couplings we've been dealing with in the standard model. In non-minimal supersymmetric models or other models, that definitely you can play with that.
Well, or if for example, you have some exotic stuff like bound states of supersymmetric particles.
Yeah, yeah.
You probably be the expert in doing something.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, all these things would be very interesting also.
But then you can do delta M business.
Yeah, so if you have some small splittings, then yeah. And narrow widths, yeah. So if you have delta M of order gamma, then yes, that's mixing is a nice way to go.
Let's thank the speaker again.